From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear our guest interviewer, Kim McQueen, in conversation with Monica Prince, assistant professor of activist and performance writing at Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania. Monica writes choreopoems, choreographed series of poems, and Kim will tell you a bit more about her guest before her interview with Monica begins. I hope you enjoy their conversation.
In a country grappling with its bloody history and uncertain future, How to Exterminate the Black Woman illuminates the struggle of the Black woman trying to thrive in a society seeking to consume and erase her. Set after the murder of Sandra Bland, or Trayvon Martin, or Emmett Till, this choreopoem takes place in the collective memory of American Black women, represented by Angela, fractured into six emotions: fear, loss, silence, expectation, fury, and new. Through chanted sestinas, yoga-inspired dances, and a chorus of the subconscious, How to Exterminate the Black Woman confronts readers and audiences with the terrors and triumphs that mark Black women in the United States, from burying their murdered children and surviving rape to going natural and falling in love. More than just hashtag Black Girl Magic, this choreopoem casts a literary spell demanding empathy, action, and humanity from the stage. Monica Prince, a Black performance poet raised by Guyanese parents, teaches activists and performance writing at Susquehanna University in central Pennsylvania, where she writes choreopoems and performance poetry. Her debut poetry collection, Instructions for Temporary Survival, 2019, won the Discovery Award for an outstanding first collection by the publisher Red Mountain Press. She is the managing editor of the Santa Fe Writers Project Quarterly and the author of the chapbook Letters from the Other Woman, Gray Book Press, 2018. Her creative work is featured in Madcap Review, The Texas Review, Track 4, and elsewhere. How to Exterminate the Black Woman is published by Pank Books, Little Book Series, 2020.
I wonder if you would want to get us started with a reading from the book.
Yeah, I'd love to do a reading. I'll just read the first poem and then one of the poems later on in the show. So because it's a choreopoem, it's written like a play. And so there are characters, there are stage directions and all that good stuff. So in the very, very beginning of the show, we start with no one is on stage except for a coat rack with different scarves. And each scarf is representative of a different woman in the show. But like, you don't know which one is which yet, so I won't even explain that. And then the curtain opens and Angela enters and she's wearing all brown. And then she dances while she recites this poem, and it's called Instructions for Temporary Survival. Okay. Beloved, you will survive this. Every day feels like a struggle, and not just because you are Black in a nation that prefers you underground. You are not underfoot, not underwater, though it may be hard to breathe in the mornings. No, you'll never be an early riser, beloved, so when you must wake at dawn, do it. Make French toast and eat slowly. Do yoga facing any open window, because frequently you won't know your way home. You won't stop loving with your whole body, so only love people just like you, or at least learn selectivity, how to identify a train wreck miles in advance. A man will swallow you. Let him. Another will try. Become ghost pepper, steel wool, a pill too large to take at once. You are too large to take at once. Your skin won't break to reveal your squishy heart. Say yes when asked to use your voice as a weapon. Say yes when asked if you deserve a country you built. Say yes when he asks you to marry him. But don't marry him. Don't exist only as adjacent to a lover who will leave, be taken from you. Remember, beloved, you are unlit candle, unlocked door, razor blade freshly sharpened. You won't love any less, but your blood will stay this hot. If no one will tell you, beloved, listen now. Your love won't save anyone. But damn it, try anyway. If anything, save yourself. If nothing, then yes, nothing.
That's really fantastic.
Thank
you. So this is the poem that opens the whole production.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the audience is watching while Angela is speaking, and what's the story that's unfolding?
So as it starts, the show itself is a bare stage production, which basically means there's almost no furniture on stage. And the benefit of that is, like, you can basically perform it anywhere, and there's no problem in terms of, you don't need a lot of props. Mm-hmm. So the audience is basically just watching this woman, like, she's dancing, but she's not dancing in terms of, like, any specific movement. It depends on the choreographer. So the first time we produced this show, well, the first time it was read as a staged reading, the choreographer had lots of, like, flowing movements, lots of arms above the head, lots of, like, big movements in the lyrical style of dancing. But then when I directed it in 2018, I had my choreographer just deeply choreograph a really specific dance based on the words that were being said. Mm-hmm. And so what the dance ended up being is it's a really slow kind of performance that is based specifically on the words. So there's lots of movement regarding, like, the idea, like, there are main words that are being choreographed. So, like, swallow gets its own movement. Mm-hmm. Remember gets its own movement. Beloved gets a repetitive movement. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing is that she's not really moving. She's not using the whole stage. She's only just using her own space on stage. Mm-hmm. And as that's happening, as she continues with the poem, Even as you think it's going to end kind of wonderfully, right, with this line of, like, remember your, you know, unlocked door, unlit candle, razor blade freshly sharpened, like, even though we have these kinds of ideas, that the idea is, like, you are potential, and even though she believes that, she kind of doesn't. Mm-hmm. And as she's saying the words, she's losing her own belief in the words she's saying, and her movements become more erratic, they become a lot more jerky, and she ends up with that final line, like, if nothing else, then yes, nothing. She collapses. Wow. And she tries to get back up, and as she's doing that, the women who she fractures into enter on stage, and she's trying to keep herself standing, but she can't manage it. And each character moves to her and tries to hold her up, and they try to move her to a different part of stage, but they all basically fail, and she ends up being flung off stage because she can't stand up on her own. And that's supposed to be representative of her fracturing into these six different women, and then those women dominate the show for the next 16 poems until the end of the show.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about the title of the work is How to Exterminate the Black Woman.
So originally the show was titled Sistina, a Black Woman in Six Parts. And that was based on the fact that the show itself is, well, I guess we can call it a Sistina Suite. I don't know if that's a thing, but that's what I'm going to call it. It's a Sistina Suite because it has six Sistinas throughout the show. And the whole show is based around the number six, There are 18 poems, which is divisible by six. There are six sestinas in the show. The sestina as a poetic form is based around the number six. Mm-hmm. There are six emotions that the Angela breaks into. Angela has six letters in her name. And so there's lots of, like, there's a lot of emphasis on the number six. So I wanted that to be in the title at first. I wanted, like, the number six to be in the title. Yeah. I wanted people to recognize that there was, like, this really old art form, poetic form. That's like a French form from like the 1600s, right? And I wanted to recognize that initially. But then I did a reading of the show in 2017 with some friends, just like at someone's apartment, which is how I revise the Choreo poem usually, is I come up with a draft, then I print a bunch of scripts, and I guess now I wouldn't do that. I do it online and just send people drafts. I print a bunch of scripts, I highlight their individual characters, and I have them all sit and read it aloud so I can hear it. And after the show was done, everyone was really... they loved it, but like there were a lot of pieces that were confusing for them. And the biggest confusion was the title. Like no one understood why it was called A Black Woman in Six Parts. Like what does that have to do with these poems that are like deeply about struggle and desire and loss? Like why would that matter, basically?
Yeah, what's the big deal about a sestina? Yeah.
That was the biggest feedback I received, which was really helpful because, and this is like the reason why everyone should get their work looked at by somebody else.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I would have missed that. I totally would have missed that because I was so focused on the six and the sestina. I was so focused on that. And it's actually still called sestina in my computer. But I remember thinking like, okay, so this has to be, it has to be about something else. And so I sat down for a while. The final poem was always Christina, but it was a poem called like Writing a Journey or something confusing, something to do with writing. And the whole poem was just about Angela trying to rewrite her future. And that's based on a practice called future writing that I learned with McKenna Held. And I wanted to like put that into the poem because the poem before that is like a spell called Battle Stations. And it's all about, you know, New trying to get the other characters on stage to put Angela back together. And so I kind of wanted to just carry that over into the very last poem. Mm-hmm. And Sestina was fine. I couldn't tell you the title of it. I don't even remember what it was called. But I remember not liking it, but I didn't have anything else. I just knew that wasn't the title. But I sat there and it's one of those moments where I had to really look at what was at stake in the show. Like, what is the show actually about? What is like, why is it that Angela leaves and comes back? Like why would she even want to come back? And I kept asking myself that. And then finally, a friend of mine was talking to me about the show and he said, you know, your goal for this performance is to put a bunch of white people in a room and tell them that Black people matter and that, like, if they don't believe that, they're contributing to the genocide of Black women. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
It's called How to Exterminate the Black Woman.
Right.
And that was the moment for me. But of course, I had the title in my head, but like, ask me if that final sestina changed, because it didn't. It didn't change until Margaret Norwood, who is a playwright and a director in Denver, she found my script from like 6 months earlier, buried at the bottom of this reject pile for something I'd submitted it to. And she's like, I've been thinking about this for 6 months and I want to direct it. We're going to do it. And I was like, okay, great. It has a new title. And she's like, fine. But it was basically the same script, right? It was like last Sestina was the same, like the characters were the same. Yeah. And so they did a staged reading of it in January of 2018, like, which is literally like 3 months before I was going to direct it on my own campus. Uh-huh. And someone, like my partner at the time, recorded it for me. And I was so grateful for him because I don't think I would have been able to see it otherwise. And I was listening to the woman who played Angela perform that final poem. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. Oh. It's just like this moment. She did it so well, but I was like, nah.
Yeah, and expose the flaw.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you're writing, yeah, yeah.
The whole show hinges on this final moment of, like, Angela basically, you know, standing her ground, and like, this poem doesn't even make sense. So I spent, like, 6 days on the floor of my office on campus, writing Sistinas, uh-huh. with the idea of the title in mind. It's like, okay, the Sistina needs to be about how to exterminate the Black woman. It needs to be about that.
You have to thread it back through something that you've already completed. Yeah.
Exactly. And I was just like, this just needs to be better. And I spent a really long time just trying to rewrite that final Sistina. And I wrote it, I think, 6 or 7 times. And it was trash every time. And then finally, I looked through, I remembered that, like, one of the ways that the benefit of writing poems that you never give to the world is that, like, they're just on your computer forever.
Yeah.
So I just started looking through old drafts of poems that I hated that I'd written before.
Oh,
And I fell into this poem called Anti-Spell for Colored Girls, I think is what I called it. And I'd written it, like, the semester before, and I didn't like it. And it was based off of a poem by Aishin Hutchinson. And I didn't like it at the time because there are too many of his words in there. And I felt like it wasn't even my poem.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I read it again. And like, there was that line in the poem. The poem started with the line, everyone knows, starting with a furious God and ending with white men. Color girls want to go extinct, but can't. And I had that line in the poem. And I remember thinking, okay, well, maybe that's how this poem starts.
Something to hang it on. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, and as soon as, because I had that line, because I had the word furious in it, I was like, oh, the N word should be the names of the characters. Cause that's how the first Sistina in the show is written. And I was like, yeah, that's like a bookend. Yeah. You know, the first Sistina has the N words with all of the characters' names, the last Sistina, those words should also be the characters' names.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back through and I wrote that poem. And when I got to the very last line where it just says, you know, when they ask you to exterminate the Black woman, like, basically you can't. I was like, oh, here it is. We've done it.
Yeah. 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 Do you want to read that? We've spent a lot of time talking about this last poem. Do you feel like reading that for listeners so we could sort of see how you tied everything together?
Absolutely. Okay, so we're in the very last scene, and the lights are up, and Angela comes back onto the stage, and she's wearing a black scarf around her waist, and the other characters stand in line, and she goes to each of them and, like, shakes their hands, and then she stands in the center, and as on every stanza, a different character leaves the stage. And as they leave, they drape the color scarf that represents them around Angela's shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So this one, the last poem, is called How to Exterminate the Black Woman. And it's also a Sistina. Everyone knows, starting with a furious God and ending with white men, silently, color girls want to go extinct, but I don't, can't. I lose track of my own legacy within all the expectation of dying. Call it resilience, perpetual, an encoded dirge, old and new trees humming the chorus, fear not. I'm never supposed to be afraid, only strong. To kill myself is not a victory. Giving in to fury is not success. No joy there. Yet silently, the blood pools at the body's back. Another black girl lost to the same oppressions and expectations of grandeur or pain. There's nothing new about a God waiting for me to lift a gun, open a new razor, strike a match. I refuse to apologize, even if I should. Fear is as natural as melanin. Are my ancestors furious with me after each failed attempt to end my life? Is their silence their way of asking me to be a little stronger? Whatever loss I calculate must remain between my heart and my hips, expecting death by cop, by brother, by my own colored hands. I am patient as I try to conjure spells for the new generation, body sewn with sinew from my flesh, fearful of asking for too much. I am tired of asking for too little. infuriated that my request for dignity and my death may be silently denied. I used to believe I could be a witch, stop losing my children and my name in the abyss of incomplete and lost history. I don't know what you expect from this black girl shattered into six parts, what new lessons you hope to learn about the fear stamped into my bone marrow. You do not ask what fury tastes like or how to navigate the pregnant silence after another of my sisters goes up in flames. You're happy silent, oblivious, uninformed, but the black woman stays lost, blamed for her children's condition, her men's incarceration, expecting a blade or pill or bullet to end her suffering before she can present new evidence of her worth, my worth. You cover your fear of my dark, magical melanin with ignorance. I mask mine with rage. Mix all the colors and expect brown. Add silence, fury, loss, and fear. Get black. Here's the new spell. When they ask how to exterminate the black woman, tell them, good luck.
Yay, thank you. That's such a great... It's such a strong, powerful ending. And when while Angela's talking, what's happening, as you mentioned, is that the women are draping her with this the different scarves that represent fear and loss and expectation and silence and fury. And at the end, where you have the last line, she remains on the stage, daring the audience to get rid of her, and the lights go down. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about the idea of choral poetry and how you got started in it, and how you came to sort of take it to this this really nice place.
Absolutely. So I started. So the first choreo poem, which obviously is, we have to talk about that if I'm going to talk about choreo poems. The first choreo poem was written by Entesaki Shange in 1975. It's called For Color Girls Who Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. Mm-hmm. And it was a like groundbreaking show. And not because women were on stage telling the truth about themselves for the first time, because that was not the first time that had happened. It was groundbreaking, I think, because it was very unapologetic in the way these women were talking about love and sex and sexual assault and abortion and friendship. And they're like, all the things they were discussing were just these ideas that we know about in a very conceptual sense, but like they're things we're basically not supposed to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Shange wrote this show in which not just women, but women of color are on stage talking about these things and making a point of just saying that they're tired and they don't know if it's worth it basically to stick around. They're tired of burying their children. They're tired of, you know, defending men who don't want to defend them. They're tired of carrying the movement. Yeah. And this is a thing I think shows up in all communities, is that those who are most affected are typically the ones who are carrying the movement. We have women and women of color who carried the suffrage movement. We had in the civil rights movement, it was black women who carried most of the black men that we remember. And I think about that a lot, about how that show, when it came out in the 70s, it was right after the civil rights movement. It was right after Dr. King had died. And it was a realization, I think, for the theater world, but also for the poetry world, that like these two things are not separate. And also, mm-hmm. it's okay for you to tell the truth about yourself in front of an audience without being confessional, if you will. It's a fun mm-hmm. people like to say about poetry when they're talking about Sylvia Plath, everything's confessional. And I'm mm-hmm. like, all the poetry my students write would be considered confessional, but I'm not going to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with the word confessional too, because I think that it belittles how important it is.
I've never really thought about it that way, but that's, it kind of separates it, right? From, yes. from journalism and from fiction and from everything we think of as like actual discourse.
Yes.
It treats it like a diary entry.
Yeah. And that's not what it is.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I think talking about what's really happening in the form of a poem doesn't make it a confession. Like, a confession is something that you actually, that is on the record somewhere, right? And I just think that I had a lot of problems with teaching that unit last year. Yeah. Because I couldn't help it. I was like, this is belittling. Like, the work these people produced is important, and confessional makes it seem small. And so I'm getting distracted, but basically,
it's an important point, I think. And I was going to ask what your students thought about it.
Well, a lot of students found the phrase to be really sexist, which I thought was interesting. Because even though a lot of confessional poets are men, the ones we learn about the most are women, like Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton. And I think about that, and I didn't even think about that when I was ranting about why I didn't like the term. But I thought a lot about how my students reacted. They were really annoyed. Because it's as if you're making it seem that it doesn't matter. That, like, when you're telling your own story, your story is unimportant if mm-hmm. it's labeled confessional.
And mm-hmm. Or not serious.
Mm-hmm. Or not serious. Mm-hmm. Or just something that we can dismiss, right? And I find that to be wildly problematic, obviously. Because I think that the whole point, like, not all stories can be made up. Like, some of them are just real. Some of them are just like the way we live in the world. Mm-hmm. So after that show came out, there was a lot of pushback from the Black community, which I found surprising, of men believing that it was a man-hating show. And the main reason for that is because there is a poem about acquaintance rape, and there's a poem about, it's called Beau Willie Brown, it's the penultimate poem of the show, and it details how a man comes back from war and he has untreated PTSD and he ends up killing his children and in front of their mother, and it's a horrifying scene, and every time I read it I cry, and every time, and the movie version of it is just as horrifying, if not more so, because, you know, cinematography.
Well, anytime you have, you know, death in front of kids, that's a problem.
Absolutely. And it's worse when it's kids dying. Like, it's so much worse. And the way we portray that scene is so impressive, but it's so emotional and it's really hard. And it's one of those things that the community picked this thing, right? And they got upset with Shange for, like, saying this. And it was under the guise that, like, if we let dominant cultures know about the struggles within communities of color, then we are giving them more ammo, basically, to destroy us. Yeah. And I think that's true, because the show could have been done by dominant cultures, and it would have fallen down the same way, because it happens everywhere, is the idea. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, so that was the first show that was the first choreo poem. She wrote like 12 more. Over her career. She passed away in 2018. Mm-hmm. And she wrote these incredible shows that just, they were written in Black English vernacular. They were written like nothing is capitalized. There's music in them. There's dance and art. And there's such an emphasis on just combining all these forms of art, basically, and these forms of creativity on stage as a way to emphasize that, like, no singular artistic form can tell the story of a person, because people are more complex than one art form. Mm-hmm. And which is why I love the form, because mm-hmm. Like, I was a dancer all through high school and college. I was I'm still a performance poet. I was a terrible painter, but I very much enjoyed doing it. At it. And as someone who just, like, enjoys all the art, right? I wanted a way to just put it all in the same place without having to, like, separate categories.
And so, it's in a couple different places now, right? Because I've got your book in my hands right now.
Yes.
I've not gotten a chance to see this performed. I really, really hope to one day, but I can participate by reading this this book.
Yes. And that's the best part.
Yeah. Well, for me it is because I, like I said, I can be a part of it and I can talk to you about it. And I'm really interested in like the sort of tension between, I mean, not tension, but how you translate that live event into a book that I can hold in my hands and talk to you about 6 months later.
Absolutely. And I think, and it was hard. It was really hard. I spent all of college and all of, well, the last half of college and all of grad school researching Koryu poems. Like, it's my expertise in, like, it's the thing I do the best and the thing I do most specifically. And as a result, like, I had to spend a lot of time figuring out, okay, how did she even do this?
Right. Yeah.
She has so many interviews and she has so many, like, essays that talk about how she did it, but it's not... It's harder than it looks, if that makes sense, because you don't necessarily need training in all these different art forms to write this show. Like, the only thing you really need to know how to do is write poetry, and from there you just kind of have to have an understanding of what it means to be on a stage. Mm-hmm. And so the thing, and this is like something, the reason why Koryu poems work so well for me is because I view everything as a performative aspect anyway. Like, from the, like, the lessons I'm going to teach to the shows that I put on, like, everything, in order for me to, like, actually make a plan, I have to be able to envision it beforehand. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes it's just, like, for small things, right? Like, I'm planning my commitment ceremony this weekend, and I keep asking my partner for details, right? Like, I need to know, is there going to be lights? Uh-huh. Do I buy new shoes?
Yeah.
Like, all these yeah. things. And he
it's important stuff.
But it's important. These are important details to think about because it helps me better put the picture in my head before I can, like, participate in the experience. Mm-hmm. And so every poem I write, I always think about how it would be performed. Right?
It sounds like something you bring to the experience rather than something you learned. Is that right?
I think that's true because I was always a performance poet. Like, it was the most fun thing to do is be on a stage and recite a poem that I'd memorized, right? And so that's something I've always enjoyed. And because I also love choreographing and I also love dancing, it made sense to just put those two things together. But I also believe that, like, the Koryu poem form can just, like, anyone can learn how to do it because it's just about being able to understand how bodies interact with text.
Yeah.
And what that could potentially look like. So if a person, like, when I write a poem, I want to be able to hear the person's voice who's going to perform it, right?
Yeah.
Or at least be able to see, like, where they would be, like, on what kind of stage, what are they wearing? If they're dancing, what kind of movements are they making? And I think about that whole process as I'm writing the poem. And I know that, like, the poem isn't very good if I can't do that as mm-hmm. I'm writing. As I'm writing it, I'm like, yeah, this isn't going to work. And then I don't feel bad about it because I'm like, yeah, this wouldn't go in a show because it doesn't make sense. I can't see it in my head. So I just kind of move on. And so when creating the Koryu poem, it requires just three things, right? It requires source material. So, like, what are you writing about, right? And a lot of my shows are based off of interviews or research, but a lot of them are just based off of lived experiences. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there needs to be an overarching premise. And that premise could be, like, anything. For How to Exterminate the Black Woman, it's obviously the title, but it's also about the idea of, like, a Black woman coming to terms with the fact that, like, the world wants her labor, but they don't want her. Mm. And how does every poem inform that idea?
Yeah.
And then I have other shows. I have a show called Roadmap that went up last year, and that was about a Black man navigating his most likely cause of death, which was homicide, mm-hmm. and basically trying to see, like, is this something he can prevent based on his, like, the decisions he makes, or is this just, like, inevitable based on his family history? And every poem, like, just feeds into that question. And then the last thing that the show needs is it needs a commitment to combining all these different art forms together. There needs to be, in the show, there needs to be a sense of, like, is someone going to be dancing? Mm-hmm. You know, if they're not dancing, why?
Right.
Is someone going to sing? I had a choir in one of my shows in my very first show, there was a choir that stood up and sang at the end of one of the pieces. Mm-hmm. And if there's not going to be, you know, singing, is someone going to paint during the show? I have a show where like someone gets up on stage and just starts painting in response to someone's performance. So every night there was like a new piece of artwork created and we'd like give away to the audience members and it was fun. Mm-hmm. And then other questions, it's like, okay, well then also there are other stuff that shows up that you might not be able to see when you're writing the show that kind of happens when, the performance happens. Like there's that poem in the show called Vinyasa, which is about like navigating sexual assault through yoga. And that poem basically wrote itself because all I knew in my head was like, I want to write about an assault and I want to talk about yoga. And so then that's what happened. And then, cause I could see it in my head. I could see a character doing yoga on stage as they're talking about their assault and trying to use the yoga as a way to distance themselves from this experience. Mm-hmm. And that was not easy to choreograph, but it was easier than the other pieces because like the movements were already put into the poem. There's just a lot of emphasis on thinking about what is it. Like, what are the different parts of performance and movement and like art that could come into the show? My second show, Something Keep Me Vertical, which is a show about love, sex, and relationships. I had a person on my cast who could do parkour. So like he, at any random interval where he had to enter or exit, he would do it in the most unnecessarily creative way possible. So jumping on walls and doing backflips and nonsense. But it was like, I couldn't write that into the show, right? Like, we're just gonna do this because I don't know if I do the show again, am I even gonna have someone who can do this? So that's kind of the fun of the show is that when it's performed, it becomes more collaborative when you have the actors and the dancers and the choreographers and the painters and all these people in the same room because they get the opportunity to build off of what you've written. And the show is never the same. Like every time someone directs it, it looks different.
I would imagine too that you have students, friends who perform in one of the productions and then they're watched by the people who are going to play some of those parts next time. And so they're sort of building on the performances that they've seen and bringing their own, energy to it. Absolutely. That might look totally different. I can't help but ask you now, I didn't mean to talk about the coronavirus while we talked, but here we are. I do want to sort of get a picture of what your fall of 2020 is going to look like, knowing that your work is so performative and collaborative. What's your thought about how you work with students on campus in the next couple of months?
Yeah, that's a great question because I am still trying to figure it out. Like I've been thinking about it basically nonstop since we ended in May. And even though our semester was interrupted and I went online, I remember I was teaching a choreo poem class in the spring when we went online and I was so defeated. I almost gave them all A's and shut it down because I was so upset.
I would have done that.
I was like, the whole point of this class is for us to perform. Like that was the whole point. And they were so devastated. They were so upset. That's all they wanted to do. And it took a lot of just cooperation from the students to just pull a script together. Because I was like, all right, how about this? Bare minimum, we pull a script together and we do an online reading for your final. And that's what we'll do. Mm-hmm. And that was good enough for them, but it wasn't what I wanted. So I'm spending a lot of this fall, because I'm not teaching choreo poem in the fall, but I am teaching all performance courses. I'm spending a lot of time thinking about how I can navigate those performances, how we can translate them to digital platforms, because not all my students will be here. We just got a note today saying that our students are moving in waves. So my seniors won't even be here till like mid-September. Mm. The rest of my students won't be here till the end of September, and that's assuming they come at all, right? So there's a lot of, I have to basically run all my classes online, sort of, for some of the time. And so I'm spending a lot of time thinking about how I can translate performative elements to the online sphere. And a lot of it is just teaching students the emotive elements of being in front of a camera, right? And this is something I really don't have to teach them because, you know, we have an entire film department that can teach them how to like be in front of a camera, a communications department that does that. Yeah. And so I usually just teach them how to be in front of people. And so now I have to like find a whole new skill set of like, how do you be in front of a camera? What happens when that camera is, you know, a Zoom call? What happens if it's a Skype call? What happens if it's just Instagram Live, right? And so I'm learning a lot about these different platforms, which has been fun.
Practical skills.
Yes, they're all practical skills, which is good, but it's a little, you know, it's a little scary and it's a little frustrating. So I know for a fact that a lot of our major assignments, like I'm teaching a performance poetry class in the fall, and we have two major events. We have a page match, which is inspired by Fear No Lit, and it's a competition, it's an on-the-spot writing competition where students write for 10 minutes and then they perform in head-to-head battles. The audience decides who wins based on what they just wrote 10 minutes ago.
Nice.
And you know, and they just, you know, they whittle them all the way down March Madness style until they get to the final, and the final person wins and they get a weird little trophy that I get off of line. And, and so like, I'm trying to find a way to translate that to an online sphere so that my students who are not going to be in person can still participate. And I think that it'll still work. I think that the way I have it in my head that it'll totally work. It's just it's all it really is spending a lot of time with students one-on-one, hyping them up and telling them that they can do this and practicing with them on camera, showing them how to use the controls, teaching them how to, how like where to look. That's usually the biggest thing is where do you look, right? Figuring out where your camera actually is and where your eyes go when you look at the camera. Does it seem like you're looking above your audience or does it seem like you're looking towards them? Things like that. And so spending a lot of time doing that, I think that there's a way to do it. I think that the downside obviously is like, I won't be able to do a choreo poem on campus, I don't think until 2021, because there's just no way. Our theater department is still planning to do shows. I don't know how. I'm giving them so much love and attention in any way possible, because they are the ones who are suffering the most from this because they can't perform shows.
Yeah.
And I mean, we can do them online, right? But it's not the same.
Right. Right. Well, then you have this great book, right, that you can give to your students and that can represent your choreo poetry work. And you can just stick it in the mail to somebody and they can read it. And that's amazing. And so much of live theater is live theater.
Yes.
You know, and you're right. We, you know, I really feel for everyone in my life who is missing being on stage.
Yeah, because it's a rush, you know.
You're back
on stage. You get to wear fun clothes and makeup and memorize somebody else's words. That's the best thing.
Well, and that's to say nothing of, you know, you mentioned at the top of our conversation about having essentially a table read. Mm-hmm. With friends of this choreo poem, How to Exterminate the Black Woman, that helped you to figure out what the right title was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not performance as we normally think of it, but it's hugely important when you're working on something that's not quite ready for the stage yet, that you have that the opportunity for that that sort of feedback and community around this work that you're developing.
Absolutely. And I think what I appreciate about the table read is something I've maintained all the way through my practice, is I always find some way to, you know, trick a bunch of people to come to my house and read this show. So typically with like cookies and food, that typically works. And it's such an important integral part of the practice of revising the show that it's something I wouldn't give up. And I know that now, because we have such great access to technology, that I know that there's a way to do this just in a different platform. Like, yeah. I know that there's a way to do it. And it's all, like, a good example. My partner is on, he's in a play right now, actually, that's entirely online. And, you know, all it takes is you change the name of your name on screen, and you change it to whatever the name of your character is.
Okay.
And that's just how it's done. And it's not a difficult process. It's a little intimidating, and it takes a lot of patience with software, but it's not an impossible process. And so I'm excited to see what that looks like, because I want to know if that's something I can translate to my students in the fall.
Yeah,
it's and also, like, the table reads, I have to do another one in a couple of months. I'm writing a new show now. And I know that one of the problems with doing a table read, well, one of the things I like about table reads with my shows is that I emphasize that, like, the people I want in the room should be people who don't perform, right? They should be people who don't know what a choreopoem is, or they know what it is, but they've never read one, or they've only been to mine, or something to that effect. And that actually, what that teaches me is, like, okay, what do these words sound like in the voice of someone who's never performed before? What are these words sound like in the voice of someone who's never read poetry before, right? And so, aside from, like, minimal guidelines I provide, where I'm like, believe in my punctuation. That's one of the things I always say, is believe in my punctuation. It's there for the reason. Do not run over the punctuation. If it's supposed to pause, pause.
Nice. So that's an important mantra. Believe in my punctuation.
Seriously.
Now we go. Yeah.
And so besides that, like, people enjoy it because it's an opportunity for them to do something kind of weird that they've never done before. And then the feedback that I get from them is always, like, deeply appreciated, because these are the people who would come to see it, right? Like, this just regular folks who might not be poets, who might not be, you know, dancers, who might not be performers. Like, they just read the stuff, and if they don't like it, that's helpful for me, because I'm like, okay, so there's probably something that's not quite hitting. If they're confused by something, then it's so much easier to revise after doing those readings than it is if I'm just writing by myself.
Definitely. Yeah, I wrote down believe in my punctuation too, because I like that a whole lot.
Good advice.
Monica, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much. My best wishes for all of the new projects you've got in the pipeline.
I appreciate that.
And just thanks again for speaking with us.
Absolutely.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was Kim McQueen's interview with Monica Prince. You can learn more about Monica's work at monicaprince.com. Kim McQueen is a writer and editor in Burlington, Vermont. She's a graduate of the MFA program in creative nonfiction at Bay Path University and has published two novels, Out, Out, and People Who Hate America. More information about Kim's work can be found at kimmcqueen.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by Kim's guest, Monica Prince, who says it was inspired by Fear No Lit in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Set a timer for 2 minutes. Write the word water at the top of your page. For the next 2 minutes, write down everything you can think of related to this word. Don't stop writing. If you get stuck, doodle or write the alphabet until you think of more to write. Once the timer goes off, reread your list. Circle the idea that most surprised you. Set another timer for 10 minutes. Write a poem in response to, related to, or about the idea you circled. Keep writing until the timer goes off. Monica actually sent Kim a second prompt, which is an exercise in writing a poem inspired by emojis, which sounds really fun. But as you might imagine, it's kind of visual in nature, and so I'm going to post it on the podcast site and you can look at it there. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. As I say every week, we are still deep in this pandemic. I hope that however isolated you are, you're able to read and write. And if possible, I hope you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And for all of you who are trying to write these days, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. As always, I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, all the other sites, or many, many other sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Next week, my guest is Diane Cook, whose new novel, The New Wilderness, has just been longlisted for the Booker Prize. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.